That's how diplomacy is affected by matters of natural philosophy, said her father. My sisters ruled the world, said her stepmother, dragging her iron shoes along the forest path. They glowed a dull orange, yet none of the dry leaves burned where the shoes touched them. The mortal folk rose up against us. They cast us down. And so we waited, in crevices, in places they do not see us. And now they adore me. Even you, my stepdaughter, even you adore me. You are so beautiful, said her mother, who had died so very long ago. Like a crimson rose, fallen in the snow. Sometimes wolves ran beside them, pounding dust and leaves up from the forest floor, although the passage of the wolves did not disturb the huge cobwebs that hung like veils across the path. Also, sometimes the wolves ran through the trunks of trees and off into the darkness. The queen liked the wolves, and was sad when one of the dwarfs began shouting, saying that the spiders were bigger than pigs, and the wolves vanished from her head and from the world. It was not so. They were only spiders of a regular size, used to spinning their webs undisturbed by time and by travelers. The drawbridge across the moat was down, and they crossed it, although everything seemed to be pushing them away. They could not enter the castle, however. Thick thorns filled the gateway, and fresh growth covered with roses. The queen saw the remains of men in the thorns, skeletons in armor and skeletons unarmored. Some of the skeletons were high on the sides of the castle, and the queen wondered if they had climbed up, seeking an entry, and died there, or if they had died on the ground and been carried upwards as the roses grew. She came to no conclusions. Either way was possible. And then her world was warm and comfortable, and she became certain that closing her eyes for only a handful of moments would not be harmful. Who would mind?
Help me, croaked the queen.
The dwarf with the brown beard pulled a thorn from the rosebush nearest to him and jabbed it hard into the queen's thumb and pulled it out again. A drop of dark blood dripped onto the flagstones of the gateway.
Ow!
Said the queen, and then,
thank you.
They stared at the thick barrier of thorns, the dwarfs and the queen. She reached out and picked a rose from the thorn creeper nearest her and bound it into her hair. We could tunnel our way in, said the dwarfs, go under the moat and into the foundations and up, only take us a couple of days. The queen pondered. Her thumb hurt, and she was pleased her thumb hurt. She said,
This began here 80 or so years ago. It began slowly. It only spread recently. It is spreading faster and faster. We do not know if the sleepers can ever wake. We do not know anything save that we may not actually have another 2 days.
She eyed the dense tangle of thorns, living and dead, decades of dried, dead plants, their thorns as sharp in death as ever they were when alive. She walked along the wall until she reached a skeleton, and she pulled the rotted cloth from its shoulders and felt it as she did so. It was dry, yes. It would make good kindling. Who has the tinderbox? She asked. The old thorns burned so hot and so fast. In 15 minutes, orange flames snaked upwards. They seemed for a moment to engulf the building, and then they were gone, leaving just blackened stone. The remaining thorns, those strong enough to have withstood the heat, were easily cut through by the queen's sword and were hauled away and tossed into the moat. The four travellers went into the castle. The old woman peered out of the slitted window at the flames below her. Smoke drifted in through the window, but neither the flames nor the roses reached the highest tower. She knew that the castle was being attacked, and she would have hidden in the tower room had there been anywhere to hide, had the sleeper not been on the bed. She swore, and began laboriously to walk down the steps, one at a time. She intended to make it down as far as the castle's battlements, where she could head over to the far side of the building, to the cellars,
She could hide there. She knew the building better than anybody. She was slow, but she was cunning, and she could wait. Oh, she could wait. She heard their calls rising up the stairwell.
This way. Up here. It feels worse this way. Come on, quickly.
She turned around, then did her best to hurry upward, but her legs moved no faster than they had when she was climbing earlier that day. They caught her just as she reached the top of the steps, three men no higher than her hips, closely followed by a young woman in travel-stained clothes, with the blackest hair the old woman had ever seen. The young woman said, "Seize her," in a tone of casual command. The little men took her stick.
"She's stronger than she looks," said one of them, his head still ringing from the blow she had got in with the stick before he had taken it.
They walked her back into the round tower room.
"The fire?"
said the old woman, who had not talked to anyone who could answer her for decades.
"Was anyone killed in the fire? Did you see the king or the queen?"
The young woman shrugged. "I don't think so. The sleepers we passed were all inside, and the walls are thick. Who are you?" "Names, names." The old woman squinted, then she shook her head. She was herself, and the name she had been born with had been eaten by time and lack of use. "Where is the princess?" The old woman just stared at her. "And why are you awake?" She said nothing. They spoke urgently to one another then, the little men and the queen.
"Is she a witch? There's a magic about her, but I do not think it's of her making."
"Guard her," said the queen. "If she is a witch, that stick might be important. Keep it from her."
"It's my stick," said the old woman. "I think it was my father's, but he had no more use for it."
The queen ignored her. She walked to the bed, pulled down the silk netting. The sleeper's face stared blindly up at them.
"So this is where it began," said one of the little men. "On her birthday," said another.
"Well," said the third, "somebody's got to do the honours."
"I shall," said the queen gently. She lowered her face to the sleeping woman's. She touched the pink lips to her own carmine lips, and she kissed the sleeping girl long and hard.
"Did it work?" asked a dwarf.
"I do not know," said the queen. "But I feel for her, poor thing, sleeping her life away."
"You slept for a year in the same witch sleep," said the dwarf. "You did not starve, you did not rot."
The figure on the bed stirred, as if she were having a bad dream from which she was fighting to wake herself. The queen ignored her. She had noticed something on the floor beside the bed. She reached down and picked it up. "Now this," she said, "this smells of magic."
"There's magic all through this," said the smallest dwarf.
"No, this," said the queen. She showed him the wooden spindle, the base half wound around with yarn. "This smells of magic."
"It was here, in this room," said the old woman suddenly, "and I was little more than a girl. I had never gone so far before, but I climbed all the steps, and I went up, and round, until I came to the topmost room. I saw that bed, the one you see, although there was nobody in it. There was only an old woman sitting on the stool, spinning wool into yarn with her spindle. I had never seen a spindle before. She asked if I would like a go. She took the wool in her hand and gave me the spindle to hold, and then she held my thumb and pressed it against the point of the spindle until blood flowed, and she touched the blooming blood to the thread, and then she said—"
A voice interrupted her. A young voice it was, a girl's voice, but still sleep-thickened.
"I said, 'Now I take your sleep from you, girl, just as I take from you your ability to harm me in my sleep, for someone needs to be awake while I sleep. Your family, your friends, your world will sleep too. And then I lay down on the bed, and I slept, and they slept, and as each of them slept, I stole a little of their life, a little of their dreams, and as I slept, I took back my youth, and my beauty, and my power. I slept, and I grew strong. I undid the ravages of time, and I built myself a world of sleeping slaves.
She was sitting up in the bed. She looked so beautiful and so very young. The queen looked at the girl and saw what she was searching for, the same look that she had seen in her stepmother's eyes, and she knew what manner of creature this girl was. "We have been led to believe," said the tallest dwarf, "that when you woke, the rest of the world would wake with you."
"Why ever would you think that?" asked the golden-haired girl, all childlike and innocent. Ah, but her eyes were so old. "I like them asleep. They are more biddable."
She stopped for a moment. Then she smiled.
"Even now, they come for you. I have called them here."
"It's a high tower," said the queen. "And sleeping people do not move fast. We still have a little time to talk, your darkness."
"Who are you?
Why would we talk? Why do you know to address me that way?" The girl climbed off the bed and stretched deliciously, pushing each finger out before running her fingertips through her golden hair. She smiled, and it was as if the sun shone into that dim room.
"The little people will stop where they are now. I do not like them. And you, girl, you will sleep too."
"No," said the queen. She hefted the spindle. The yarn wrapped around it was black with age and with time. The dwarfs stopped where they stood, and they swayed and closed their eyes. The queen said,
"It's always the same with your kind. You need youth and you need beauty. You used your own up so long ago, and now you find ever more complex ways of obtaining them, and you always want power."
They were almost nose to nose now, and the fair-haired girl seemed so much younger than the queen.
"Why don't you just go to sleep?"
asked the girl, and she smiled guilelessly, just as the queen's stepmother had smiled when she wanted something. There was a noise on the stairs, far below them.
"I slept for a year in a glass coffin," said the queen,
"and the woman who put me there was much more powerful and dangerous than you will ever be."
"More powerful than I am?"
The girl seemed amused.
"I have a million sleepers under my control. With every moment that I slept, I grew in power, and the circle of dreams grows faster and faster with every passing day. I have my youth, so much youth. I have my beauty. No weapon can harm me. Nobody alive is more powerful than I am."
She stopped and stared at the queen.
"You are not of our blood," she said, "but you have some of the skill."
She smiled, the smile of an innocent girl who has woken on a spring morning.
"Ruling the world will not be easy, nor will maintaining order among those of the sisterhood who have survived into this degenerate age. I will need someone to be my eyes and ears, to administer justice, to attend to things when I am otherwise engaged. I will stay at the center of the web. You will not rule with me, but beneath me. But you will still rule, and rule continents, not just a tiny kingdom."
She reached out a hand and stroked the queen's pale skin, which, in the dim light of that room, seemed almost as white as snow. The queen said nothing.
"Love me," said the girl. "All will love me, and you, who woke me, you must love me most of all.
The queen felt something stirring in her heart. She remembered her stepmother then. Her stepmother had liked to be adored. Learning how to be strong, to feel her own emotions and not another's, had been hard. But once you learned the trick of it, you did not forget. And she did not wish to rule continents. The girl smiled at her, with eyes the color of the morning sky. The queen did not smile. She reached out her hand. "Here," she said, "this is not mine." She passed the spindle to the old woman beside her. The old woman hefted it thoughtfully. She began to unwrap the yarn from the spindle with arthritic fingers. "This was my life," she said. "This thread was my life." "It was your life. You gave it to me," said the sleeper irritably, "and it has gone on much too long." The tip of the spindle was still sharp, after so many decades. The old woman, who had once been a princess, held the yarn tightly in her hand, and she thrust the point of the spindle at the golden-haired girl's breast. The girl looked down as a trickle of red blood ran down her breast and stained her white dress crimson. "No weapon can harm me," she said, and her girlish voice was petulant. "Not any more. Look, it's only a scratch." "It's not a weapon," said the queen, who understood what had happened. "It's your own magic, and a scratch is all that was needed." The girl's blood soaked into the thread that had once been wrapped about the spindle, the thread that ran from the spindle to the raw wool in the old woman's hand. The girl looked down at the blood staining her dress and at the blood on the thread, and she said only, "It was just a prick of the skin, nothing more." She seemed confused. The noise on the stairs was getting louder, a slow, irregular shuffling, as if 100 sleepwalkers were coming up a stone spiral staircase with their eyes closed. The room was small, and there was nowhere to hide, and the room's window was a narrow slit in the stones. The old woman, who had not slept in so many decades, she who had once been a princess, said, "You took my dreams, you took my sleep. Now that's enough of all that." She was a very old woman. Her fingers were gnarled, like the roots of a hawthorn bush. Her nose was long and her eyelids drooped, but there was a look in her eyes at that moment that was the look of someone young. She swayed, and then she staggered, and she would have fallen to the floor if the queen had not caught her first. The queen carried the old woman to the bed, marveling at how little she weighed, and placed her on the crimson counterpane. The old woman's chest rose and fell. The noise on the stairs was louder now, then a silence, followed suddenly by a hubbub, as if 100 people were talking at once, all surprised and angry and confused. The beautiful girl said, "But..." And now there was nothing girlish or beautiful about her. Her face fell and became less shapely. She reached down to the smallest dwarf, pulled his hand axe from his belt. She fumbled with the axe, held it up threateningly, with hands all wrinkled and worn. The queen drew her sword. The blade edge was notched and damaged from the thorns. But instead of striking, she took a step backwards. "Listen, they are waking up," she said. "They are all waking up. Tell me again about the youth you stole from them. Tell me again about your beauty and your power. Tell me again how clever you were, your darkness." When the people reached the tower room, they saw an old woman asleep on a bed, and they saw the queen standing tall, and beside her the dwarfs, who were shaking their heads or scratching them. They saw something else on the floor also. A tumble of bones, a hank of hair as fine and as white as fresh-spun cobwebs, a tracery of grey rags across it, and over all of it, an oily dust. "Take care of her," said the queen, pointing with the dark wooden spindle at the old woman on the bed. "She saved your lives." She left then,
with the dwarfs. None of the people in that room or on the steps dared to stop them, or would ever understand what had happened. A mile or so from the castle, in a clearing in the forest of Acare, the queen and the dwarfs lit a fire of dry twigs, and in it they burned the thread and the fibre. The smallest dwarf chopped the spindle into fragments of black wood with his axe, and they burned them too. The wood chips gave off a noxious smoke as they burned, which made the queen cough, and the smell of old magic was heavy in the air. Afterwards, they buried the charred wooden fragments beneath a rowan tree. By evening, they were on the outskirts of the forest and had reached a cleared track. They could see a village across the hill and smoke rising from the village chimneys. "So," said the dwarf with the beard, "if we head due west, we can be at the mountains by the end of the week, and we'll have you back in your palace in Cancelaire within 10 days. "Yes," said the queen. "And your wedding will be late, but it will happen soon after your return, and the people will celebrate, and there will be joy unbounded through the kingdom." "Yes," said the queen. She said nothing but sat on the moss beneath an oak tree and tasted the stillness, heartbeat by heartbeat. "There are choices," she thought, when she had sat long enough. "There are always choices." She made her choice. The queen began to walk, and the dwarfs followed her. "You do know we're heading east, don't you?" said one of the dwarfs. "Oh, yes," said the queen. "Well, that's all right, then," said the dwarf. They walked to the east, all four of them, away from the sunset and the lands they knew, and into the night. Witch work. The witch was as old as the mulberry tree. She lived in the house of 100 clocks. She sold storms and sorrows and calmed the sea, and she kept her life in a box. The tree was the oldest that I'd ever seen. Its trunk flowed like liquid. It dripped with age. But every September its fruit stained the green as scarlet, as harlots, as red as my rage. The clocks whispered time, which they caught in their gears. They crept and they chattered, they chimed and they chewed. She fed them on minutes, the old ones 8 years. She feared and she loved them, her wild, clocky brood. She sold me a storm when my anger was strong, and my hate filled the world with volcanoes and laughter. I watched as the lightnings and wind sang their song, and my madness was swallowed by what happened after. She sold me 3 sorrows, all wrapped in a cloth. The first one I gave to my enemy's child. The second my woman made into a broth. The third waits unused, for we reconciled. She sold calm seas to the mariner's wives, bound the winds with silk cords so the storms could be tied there. The women at home lived much happier lives till their husbands returned and their patience be tried there. The witch hid her life in a box made of dirt, as big as a fist and as dark as a heart. There was nothing but time there, and silence and hurt, while the witch watched the waves with her pain and her art. But he never came back. He never came back. The witch was as old as the mulberry tree. She lived in the house of 100 clocks. She sold storms and sorrows, and calmed the sea, and she kept her life in a box. In Relig Oran. When St. Columba landed on the island of Iona, his friend Oran landed with him, though some say St. Oran waited in the shadows of the island, waiting for the saint to land there. I believe they came together, came from Ireland, were like brothers with a blonde and brave Columba, and the dark man they called Oran. He was Oran like the otter was the other. There were others, and they landed on Iona, and they said, "We'll build a chapel." It's what saints did when they landed. Oran, priest of sun or fire, or from Ora, meaning dark-haired, but their chapel kept on crumbling, and Columba took the answer from a dream or revelation that his building needed Oran, needed death in the foundations. Others claim it was doctrinal, and Saints Oran and Columba were debating, as the Irish love debating, about heaven. Since the truth is long forgotten, we are left with just their actions. By their actions shall ye know them. Saint Columba buried Oran, still alive, with earth about him, buried deep with earth upon him. 3 days later they returned there, stocky monks with spades and mattocks, and they dug down to St. Oran so Columba could embrace him, touch his face and say his farewells. 3 days dead, they brushed the mud off. When St. Oran's eyes blinked open, Oran grinned at St. Columba. He had died but now was risen, and he said the words the dead know in a voice like wind and water. He said, "Heaven is not waiting for the good and pure and gentle. There's no punishment eternal. There's no hell for the ungodly, nor is God as you imagine." St. Columba shouted, "Quiet!" And to save the monks from error, shoveled mud onto St. Oran, so they buried him forever, and they called the place St. Oran's. In its churchyard, kings of Scotland, kings of Norway, all were buried on the island of Iona. Some folk claim it was a druid priest of sunlight that was buried in the earth of good Iona just to hold the church foundations, but for me that's much too simple, and it libels St. Columba, who cried, "Earth! Throw earth on Oran! Stop his mouth with mud this moment, lest he bring us to perdition!" They imagine it a murder, as one saint entombed another underneath that holy chapel. While St. Oran's name continues, martyred heretic, his bones still hold the chapel stones together, and we join them, kings and princes, in his graveyard, in his chapel, for it's Oran's name they carry. He's embraced in his damnation by the simple words he uttered. "There's no hell to spite the sinners, there's no heaven for the blessed. God is not what you imagine." And perhaps he kept on preaching. For he'd died and he had risen, until silenced, crushed or muffled by the soil of Iona. St. Columba, he was buried on the island of Iona decades later, but they disinterred his body and they took it to Downpatrick, where it's buried with St. Patrick and St. Brigid. So the only saint is Oran, on the island of Iona. Don't go digging in that graveyard for the kings of old, the mighty, or archbishops and their riches. They are guarded by St. Oran, who will rise up from the grave dirt like the darkness, like an otter, for he sees the sun no longer. He will touch you, he will taste you, he will leave his words inside you. God is not what you imagine, nor is hell, and nor is heaven. Then you'll leave him and his graveyard, and forget the shadow's terror. As you rub your neck, remember only this: he died to save us, and that St. Columba killed him on the island of Iona. Black Dog. There were 10 tongues within one head, and one went out to fetch some bread to feed the living and the dead. Old Riddle. 1. The Bar Guest. Outside the pub, it was raining cats and dogs. Shadow was still not entirely convinced that he was in a pub. True, there was a tiny bar at the back of the room, with bottles behind it and a couple of the huge taps you pulled, and there were several high tables, and people were drinking at the tables, but it all felt like a room in somebody's house. The dogs helped reinforce that impression. It seemed to Shadow that everybody in the pub had a dog except for him. "What kind of dogs are they?" Shadow asked, curious. The dogs reminded him of greyhounds, but they were smaller and seemed saner, more placid and less high-strung than the greyhounds he had encountered over the years. "Lurchers," said the pub's landlord, coming out from behind the bar. He was carrying a pint of beer that he had poured for himself. "Best dogs, poacher's dogs. Fast, smart, lethal." He bent down, scratched a chestnut and white brindled dog behind the ears. The dog stretched and luxuriated in the ear scratching. It did not look particularly lethal, and Shadow said so. The landlord, his hair a mop of grey and orange, scratched at his beard reflectively. "That's where you'd be wrong," he said.
I walked with his brother last week down Cumsey Lane. There's a fox, a big red reynard, pokes his head out of a hedge, no more than 20 meters down the road, then plain as day saunters out onto the track. Well, Needles sees it, and he's off after it like the clappers. Next thing you know, Needles has his teeth in Reynard's neck, and one bite, one hard shake, and it's all over. Shadow inspected Needles, a grey dog sleeping by the little fireplace. He looked harmless too. So what sort of a breed is a lurcher? It's an English breed, yes? It's not actually a breed, said a white-haired woman without a dog, who had been leaning on a nearby table. They're crossbred for speed, stamina, sighthound, greyhound, collie. The man next to her held up a finger. You must understand, he said cheerfully, that there used to be laws about who could own purebred dogs. The local folk couldn't, but they could own mongrels, and lurchers are better and faster than pedigree dogs. He pushed his spectacles up his nose with the tip of his forefinger. He had a mutton-chop beard, brown flecked with white. Ask me, all mongrels are better than pedigree anything, said the woman. It's why America is such an interesting country, filled with mongrels. Shadow was not certain how old she was. Her hair was white, but she seemed younger than her hair. Actually, darling, said the man with the mutton chops in his gentle voice, I think you'll find that the Americans are keener on pedigree dogs than the British. I met a woman from the American Kennel Club, and honestly, she scared me. I was scared. I wasn't talking about dogs, Ollie, said the woman. I was talking about... Oh, never mind. What are you drinking? Asked the landlord. There was a handwritten piece of paper taped to the wall by the bar, telling customers not to order a lager, as a punch in the face often offends. What's good and local? Asked Shadow, who had learned that this was mostly the wisest thing to say. The landlord and the woman had various suggestions as to which of the various local beers and ciders were good. The little mutton-chopped man interrupted them to point out that in his opinion, good was not the avoidance of evil, but something more positive than that, it was making the world a better place. Then he chuckled to show that he was only joking and that he knew that the conversation was really only about what to drink. The beer the landlord poured for Shadow was dark and very bitter. He was not certain that he liked it. What is it? It's called Black Dog, said the woman. I've heard people say it was named after the way you feel, after you've had one too many. Like Churchill's moods, said the little man. Actually, the beer is named after a local dog, said a younger woman. She was wearing an olive-green sweater and standing against the wall. But not a real one, semi-imaginary. Shadow looked down at Needles, then hesitated. Is it safe to scratch his head? He asked, remembering the fate of the fox. Course it is, said the white-haired woman. He loves it, don't you? Well, he practically had that tosser from Glossop's finger off, said the landlord. There was admiration mixed with warning in his voice. I think he was something in local government, said the woman, and I've always thought that there's nothing wrong with dogs biting them. Or VAT inspectors. The woman in the green sweater moved over to Shadow. She was not holding a drink. She had dark, short hair and a crop of freckles that spattered her nose and cheeks. She looked at Shadow. You aren't in local government, are you? Shadow shook his head. He said, I'm kind of a tourist. It was not actually untrue. He was travelling anyway. You're Canadian, said the mutton chop man. American, said Shadow, but I've been on the road for a while now. Then, said the white-haired woman, you aren't actually a tourist. Tourists turn up, see the sights, and leave. Shadow shrugged, smiled, and leaned down. He scratched the landlord's lurcher on the back of its head. You're not a dog person, are you? Asked the dark-haired woman. I'm not a dog person, said Shadow.
Had he been someone else, someone who talked about what was happening inside his head, Shadow might have told her that his wife had owned dogs when she was younger and sometimes called Shadow Puppy because she wanted a dog she could not have. But Shadow kept things on the inside. It was one of the things he liked about the British. Even when they wanted to know what was happening on the inside, they did not ask. The world on the inside remained the world on the inside. His wife had been dead for 3 years now. "If you ask me," said the man with the mutton chops, "people are either dog people or cat people. So would you then consider yourself a cat person?" Shadow reflected. "I don't know. We never had pets when I was a kid. We were always on the move, but..." "I mention this," the man continued, "because our host also has a cat, which you might wish to see." "Used to be out here, but we moved it to the back room," said the landlord from behind the bar. Shadow wondered how the man could follow the conversation so easily while also taking people's meal orders and serving their drinks. "Did the cat upset the dogs?" he asked. Outside, the rain redoubled. The wind moaned and whistled, and then howled. The log fire burning in the little fireplace coughed and spat. "Not in the way you're thinking," said the landlord. "We found it when we knocked through into the room next door, when we needed to extend the bar." The man grinned. "Come and look." Shadow followed the man into the room next door. The mutton chop man and the white-haired woman came with them, walking a little behind Shadow. Shadow glanced back into the bar. The dark-haired woman was watching him, and she smiled warmly when he caught her eye. The room next door was better lit, larger, and it felt a little less like somebody's front room. People were sitting at tables, eating. The food looked good and smelled better. The landlord led Shadow to the back of the room, to a dusty glass case. "There she is," said the landlord proudly. The cat was brown, and it looked, at first glance, as if it had been constructed out of tendons and agony. The holes that were its eyes were filled with anger and with pain. The mouth was wide open, as if the creature had been yowling when she was turned to leather. The practice of placing animals in the walls of buildings is similar to the practice of walling up children alive in the foundations of a house you want to stay up, explained the mutton chop man from behind him. "Although mummified cats always make me think of the mummified cats they found around the Temple of Bast in Bubastis in Egypt. So many tons of mummified cats that they sent them to England to be ground up as cheap fertilizer and dumped on the fields. The Victorians also made paint out of mummies, a sort of brown, I believe." "It looks miserable," said Shadow. "How old is it?" The landlord scratched his cheek. "We reckon that the wall she was in went up somewhere between 1300 and 1600. That's from parish records. There's nothing here in 1300, and there's a house in 1600. The stuff in the middle was lost." The dead cat in the glass case, furless and leathery, seemed to be watching them from its empty black hole eyes. "I got eyes wherever my folk walk," breathed a voice in the back of Shadow's mind. He thought, momentarily, about the fields fertilized with the ground mummies of cats, and what strange crops they must have grown. "They put him into an old house side," said the man called Ollie, "and there he lived, and there he died, and nobody either laughed or cried." All sorts of things were walled up to make sure that things were guarded and safe. Children sometimes. Animals. They did it in churches as a matter of course. The rain beat in a rhythmic rattle on the window pane. Shadow thanked the landlord for showing him the cat. They went back into the taproom. The dark-haired woman had gone, which gave Shadow a moment of regret. She had looked so friendly. Shadow bought a round of drinks for the mutton chop man, the white-haired woman, and one for the landlord. The landlord ducked behind the bar. "They call me Shadow," Shadow told them. "Shadow Moon." The mutton chop man pressed his hands together in delight. "Oh, how wonderful! I had an Alsatian named Shadow when I was a boy. Is it your real name?" "It's what they call me,"
said Shadow. "I'm Moira Callanish," said the white-haired woman. "This is my partner, Oliver Bierce. He knows a lot, and he will, during the course of our acquaintance, undoubtedly tell you everything he knows." They shook hands. When the landlord returned with their drinks, Shadow asked if the pub had a room to rent. He had intended to walk further that night, but the rain sounded like it had no intention of giving up. He had stout walking shoes and weather-resistant outer clothes, but he did not want to walk in the rain. "I used to, but then my son moved back in. I'll encourage people to sleep it off in the barn on occasion, but that's as far as I'll go these days." "Anywhere in the village I could get a room?" The landlord shook his head. "It's a foul night. But Porset is only a few miles down the road, and they've got a proper hotel there. I can call Sandra. Tell her that you're coming. What's your name?" "Shadow," said Shadow again. "Shadow Moon." Moira looked at Oliver and said something that sounded like waifs and strays. And Oliver chewed his lip for a moment, and then he nodded enthusiastically. "Would you fancy spending the night with us? The spare room's a bit of a box room, but it does have a bed in it, and it's warm there, and dry." "I'd like that very much," said Shadow. "I can pay." "Don't be silly," said Moira. "It will be nice to have a guest." 2. The Gibbet. Oliver and Moira both had umbrellas. Oliver insisted that Shadow carry his umbrella, pointing out that Shadow towered over him and thus was ideally suited to keep the rain off both of them. The couple also carried little flashlights, which they called torches. The word put Shadow in mind of villagers in a horror movie storming the castle on the hill, and the lightning and thunder added to the vision. "Tonight, my creature," he thought, "I will give you life." It should have been hokey, but instead it was disturbing. The dead cat had put him into a strange set of mind. The narrow roads between fields were running with rainwater. "On a nice night," said Moira, raising her voice to be heard over the rain, "we would just walk over the fields, but they'll be all soggy and boggy, so we're going down by Shuck's Lane. Now, that tree was a gibbet tree once upon a time." She pointed to a massive trunked sycamore of the crossroads. It had only a few branches left, sticking up into the night like afterthoughts. "Moira's lived here since she was in her 20s, said Oliver. "I came up from London about 8 years ago, from Turnham Green. I'd come up here on holiday originally when I was 14, and I never forgot it. You don't." "The land gets into your blood," said Moira. "Sort of." "And the blood gets into the land," said Oliver, "one way or another. You take that gibbet tree, for example. They would leave people in the gibbet until there was nothing left. Hair gone to make birds' nests, flesh all eaten by ravens, bones picked clean. Or until they had another corpse to display. Anyway." Shadow was fairly sure he knew what a gibbet was, but he asked anyway. There was never any harm in asking, and Oliver was definitely the kind of person who took pleasure in knowing peculiar things and in passing his knowledge on. "Like a huge iron birdcage. They used them to display the bodies of executed criminals after justice had been served. The gibbets were locked, so the family and friends couldn't steal the body back and give it a good Christian burial, keeping passers-by on the straight and the narrow, although I doubt it actually deterred anyone from anything." "Who were they executing?" "Anyone who got unlucky. 300 years ago, there were over 200 crimes punishable by death, including travelling with gypsies for more than a month, stealing sheep, and for that matter anything over 12 pence in value, and writing a threatening letter." He might have been about to begin a lengthy list, but Moira broke in. "Oliver's right about the death sentence, but they only gibbeted murderers up these parts, and they'd leave corpses in the gibbet for 20 years sometimes. We didn't get a lot of murders." And then, as if trying to change the subject to something lighter, she said, "We are now walking down Shuck's Lane. The locals say that on a clear night, which tonight certainly is not, you can find yourself being followed by Black Shuck. He's sort of a fairy dog." "We've never seen him, not even on clear nights," said Oliver. "Which is a very good thing," said Moira, "because if you see him,
You die.
Except Sandra Wilberforce said she saw him, and she's healthy as a horse.
Shadow smiled. What does Black Shuck do?
He doesn't do anything, said Oliver.
He does. He follows you home, corrected Moira, and then, a bit later, you die.
Doesn't sound very scary, said Shadow, except for the dying bit.
They reached the bottom of the road. Rainwater was running like a stream over Shadow's thick hiking boots. Shadow said,
So how did you two meet?
It was normally a safe question when you were with couples.
Oliver said, In the pub. I was up here on holiday, really.
Moira said, I was with someone when I met Oliver. We had a very brief, torrid affair, then we ran off together, most unlike both of us. They did not seem like the kind of people who ran off together, thought Shadow, but then all people were strange. He knew he should say something.
I was married. My wife was killed in a car crash.
I'm so sorry, said Moira.
It happened, said Shadow.
When we get home, said Moira, I'm making us all whiskey max. That's whiskey and ginger wine and hot water. And I'm having a hot bath, otherwise I'll catch my death.
Shadow imagined reaching out his hand and catching death in it, like a baseball. And he shivered. The rain redoubled, and a sudden flash of lightning burned the world into existence all around them, every grey rock in the dry stone wall. Every blade of grass, every puddle and every tree was perfectly illuminated, and then swallowed by a deeper darkness, leaving after images on Shadow's night-blinded eyes.
"Did you see that?" asked Oliver. "Damnedest thing."
The thunder rolled and rumbled, and Shadow waited until it was done before he tried to speak.
I didn't see anything, said Shadow.
Another flash, less bright, and Shadow thought he saw something moving away from them, in a distant field.
That? He asked. It's a donkey, said Moira. Only a donkey.
Oliver stopped. He said,
This was the wrong way to come home. We should have got a taxi. This was a mistake.
Ollie, said Moira, it's not far now, and it's just a spot of rain. You aren't made of sugar, darling. Another flash of lightning, so bright as to be almost blinding. There was nothing to be seen in the fields. Darkness. Shadow turned back to Oliver, but the little man was no longer standing beside him. Oliver's flashlight was on the ground. Shadow blinked his eyes, hoping to force his night vision to return. The man had collapsed, crumpled onto the wet grass on the side of the lane.
Ollie?
Moira crouched beside him, her umbrella by her side. She shone her flashlight onto his face. Then she looked at Shadow.
He can't just sit here, she said, sounding confused and concerned. It's pouring.
Shadow pocketed Oliver's flashlight, handed his umbrella to Moira, then picked Oliver up. The man did not seem to weigh much, and Shadow was a big man.
Is it far?
Not far, she said. Not really. We're almost home.
They walked in silence, across a churchyard on the edge of a village green and into a village. Shadow could see lights on in the grey stone houses that edged the one street. Moira turned off into a house set back from the road, and Shadow followed her. She held the back door open for him. The kitchen was large and warm, and there was a sofa half covered with magazines against one wall. There were low beams in the kitchen, and Shadow needed to duck his head. Shadow removed Oliver's raincoat and dropped it. It puddled on the wooden floor. Then he put the man down on the sofa. Moira filled the kettle.
Do we call an ambulance?
She shook her head.
This is just something that happens? He falls down and passes out?
Moira busied herself getting mugs from a shelf.
It's happened before, just not for a long time. He's narcoleptic, and if something surprises or scares him, he can just go down like that. He'll come round soon. He'll want tea. No whiskey mac tonight, not for him. Sometimes he's a bit dazed and doesn't know where he is. Sometimes he's been following everything that happened while he was out. And he hates it if you make a fuss. Put your backpack down by the Aga.
The kettle boiled. Moira poured the steaming water into a teapot. "He'll have a cup of real tea. I'll have chamomile, I think, or I won't sleep tonight. Calm my nerves. You?"
"I'll drink tea, sure," said Shadow. He had walked more than 20 miles that day, and sleep would be easy in the finding.
He wondered at Moira. She appeared perfectly self-possessed in the face of her partner's incapacity, and he wondered how much of it was not wanting to show weakness in front of a stranger. He admired her, although he found it peculiar. The English was strange. But he understood hating, making a fuss. "Yes." Oliver stirred on the couch. Moira was at his side with a cup of tea, helped him into a sitting position. He sipped the tea in a slightly dazed fashion.
"It followed me home," he said conversationally.
"What followed you, Ollie darling?" Her voice was steady, but there was concern in it.
"The dog," said the man on the sofa, and he took another sip of his tea.
"The black dog?"
3. The cuts. These were the things Shadow learned that night, sitting around the kitchen table with Moira and Oliver. He learned that Oliver had not been happy or fulfilled in his London advertising agency job. He had moved up to the village and taken an extremely early medical retirement. Now, initially for recreation and increasingly for money, he repaired and rebuilt dry stone walls. There was, he explained, an art and a skill to wall building. It was excellent exercise and, when done correctly, a meditative practice. "There used to be hundreds of dry stone wall people around here. Now there's barely a dozen who know what they're doing. You see walls repaired with concrete or with breeze blocks. It's a dying art. I'd love to show you how I do it. Useful skill to have. Picking the rock. Sometimes you have to let the rock tell you where it goes. And then it's immovable. You couldn't knock it down with a tank. Remarkable." He learned that Oliver had been very depressed several years earlier, shortly after Moira and he got together, but that for the last few years he had been doing very well. Or, he amended, relatively well. He learned that Moira was independently wealthy, that her family trust fund had meant that she and her sisters had not needed to work, but that, in her late 20s, she had gone for teacher training. That she no longer taught, but that she was extremely active in local affairs and had campaigned successfully to keep the local bus routes in service. Shadow learned, from what Oliver didn't say, that Oliver was scared of something, very scared, and that when Oliver was asked what had frightened him so badly and what he had meant by saying that the black dog had followed him home, his response was to stammer and to sway. He learned not to ask Oliver any more questions. This is what Oliver and Moira had learned about Shadow, sitting around that kitchen table. Nothing much. Shadow liked them. He was not a stupid man. He had trusted people in the past who had betrayed him. But he liked this couple, and he liked the way their home smelled, like bread making, and jam, and walnut wood polish. And he went to sleep that night in his box room bedroom, worrying about the little man with the mutton chop beard. What if the thing Shadow had glimpsed in the field had not been a donkey? What if it had been an enormous dog? What then? The rain had stopped when Shadow woke. He made himself toast in the empty kitchen. Moira came in from the garden, letting a gust of chilly air in through the kitchen door. "Sleep well?" she asked. "Yes, very well." He had dreamed of being at the zoo. He had been surrounded by animals he could not see that snuffled and snorted in their pens. He was a child, walking with his mother, and he was safe, and he was loved. He had stopped in front of a lion's cage, but what had been in the cage was a sphinx, half lion and half woman, her tail swishing. She had smiled at him, and her smile had been his mother's smile. He heard her voice, accented and warm and feline. It said, "Know thyself." "I know who I am," said Shadow in his dream, holding the bars of the cage. Behind the bars was the desert. He could see pyramids. He could see shadows on the sand.
"Then who are you, Shadow?" What are you running from? Where are you running to? Who are you?
And he had woken, wondering why he was asking himself that question, and missing his mother who had died 20 years before when he was a teenager. He still felt oddly comforted, remembering the feel of his hand in his mother's hand.
I'm afraid Ollie's a bit under the weather this morning.
Sorry to hear that.
Yes, well, can't be helped.
I'm really grateful for the room. I guess I'll be on my way.
Moira said, Will you look at something for me?
Shadow nodded, then followed her outside and round the side of the house. She pointed to the rose bed.
What does that look like to you?
Shadow bent down. The footprint of an enormous hound, he said, to quote Dr. Watson.
Yes, she said. It really does.
If there is a spectral ghost hound out there, said Shadow, it shouldn't leave footprints, should it?
I'm not actually an authority on these matters, said Moira. I had a friend once who could have told us all about it, but she...
She trailed off.
Then, more brightly, you know, Mrs. Camberley, two doors down, has a Doberman pincher. Ridiculous thing.
Shadow was not certain whether the ridiculous thing was Mrs. Camberley or her dog. He found the events of the previous night less troubling and odd, more explicable. What did it matter if a strange dog had followed them home? Oliver had been frightened or startled and had collapsed from narcolepsy, from shock.
Well, I'll pack you some lunch before you go, said Moira. Boiled eggs, that sort of thing. You'll be glad of them on the way.
They went into the house. Moira went to put something away and returned looking shaken.
Oliver's locked himself in the bathroom, she said.
Shadow was not certain what to say.
You know what I wish? She continued.
I don't.
I wish you would talk to him. I wish he would open the door. I wish he'd talk to me. I can hear him in there. I can hear him.
And then,
I hope he isn't cutting himself again.
Shadow walked back into the hall, stood by the bathroom door, called Oliver's name.
Can you hear me? Are you okay?
Nothing. No sound from inside. Shadow looked at the door. It was solid wood. The house was old, and they built them strong and well back then. When Shadow had used the bathroom that morning, he'd seen the lock was a hook and eye. He leaned on the handle of the door, pushing it down, then rammed his shoulder against the door. It opened with a noise of splintering wood. He had watched a man die in prison, stabbed in a pointless argument. He remembered the way that the blood had puddled about the man's body, lying in the back corner of the exercise yard. The sight had troubled Shadow, but he had forced himself to look and to keep looking. To look away would somehow have felt disrespectful. Oliver was naked on the floor of the bathroom. His body was pale, and his chest and groin were covered with thick, dark hair. He held the blade from an ancient safety razor in his hands. He had sliced his arms with it, his chest above the nipples, his inner thighs, and his penis. Blood was smeared on his body, on the black and white linoleum floor, on the white enamel of the bathtub. Oliver's eyes were round and wide, like the eyes of a bird. He was looking directly at Shadow, but Shadow was not certain that he was being seen.
Ollie?
Said Moira's voice from the hall. Shadow realized that he was blocking the doorway, and he hesitated, unsure whether to let her see what was on the floor or not. Shadow took a pink towel from the towel rail and wrapped it around Oliver. That got the little man's attention. He blinked, as if seeing Shadow for the first time, and said,
The dog. It's for the dog. It must be fed, you see. We're making friends.
Moira said,
Oh, my dear sweet God.
I'll call the emergency services.
Please don't, she said. He'll be fine at home with me. I don't know what I'll... Please?
Shadow picked up Oliver, swaddled in the towel, carried him into the bedroom as if he were a child, and then placed him on the bed. Moira followed. She picked up an iPad by the bed, touched the screen, and music began to play.
"Breathe, Ollie," she said. "Remember, breathe. It's going to be fine. You're going to be fine."
"I can't really breathe," said Oliver, in a small voice. "Not really. I can feel my..."